This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 6, 2007. I'm Kat Aaron in New York, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Some 20,000 people mark the start of a 40-day fast for debt cancellation. We go to Morocco, where voters are preparing to head to the polls tomorrow. And as calls for a troop drawdown grow, a new report fuels debate in Congress about the Iraqi security forces. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A federal judge in New York today struck down the national security letter provision of the USA Patriot Act. National security letters have allowed federal investigators to demand personal information from companies or institutions without a warrant. National security letters also legally gag their recipients from going public about the letters or the information requested therein. The case was brought by the ACLU on behalf of an unnamed internet service provider that received a national security letter to turn over customer data. That same internet provider was prevented by the NSL gag provision from coming forward during congressional debate to reauthorize the Patriot Act. A report released earlier this year by the Justice Department's Inspector General found that the DOJ issued more than 143,000 national security letters between 2003 and 2005. In other news, a U.S. airstrike over Baghdad today killed 14 people and wounded 9 others. Hiba Dawood has more.
The airstrike hit the Washash neighborhood of western Baghdad at approximately 3 a.m. Iraqi police say the attack killed 14 people and injured 9 others in addition to destroying several homes. The U.S. military says the buildings were being used by Shiite militants who set up fake checkpoints and carry out sectarian kidnappings. A statement from the military claims that the airstrike came after U.S. and Iraqi security forces in the area came under fire from armed men on rooftops. But local residents have told reporters that they heard nothing prior to the sound of heavy fire from tanks followed by missiles dropped from the sky. Residents say the buildings destroyed in the airstrikes were family homes, not insurgents' hideouts. The Washash neighborhood is known as the stronghold of the militia led by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Sadr recently issued orders of a 6-month suspension on military operations, a decision criticized by dissident elements within the Mahdi army. This is Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Syria claims that Israeli warplanes violated its airspace today. Syria's state-run news agency says that the Israeli planes dropped ammunition over an unpopulated area as Syrian air defenses fired on the planes and forced their retreat. The Israeli military has not responded to the allegations, other than to say there would be no comment. Israel and Syria have technically been at war since 1974, when Syria tried to retake the Golan Heights, a plateau seized by Israel in the Six-Day War of 1967. A massive joint naval exercise in India's Bay of Bengal has provoked protests from the country's leftist political parties. Bismillah Jalani reports from New Delhi.
India is hosting the largest naval exercises ever in the Bay of Bengal, with the United States, Japan, Australia, and Singapore as participants. The war games begin on Tuesday and will continue until September 9 in the international waters between Visakhapatnam and the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. The left parties of India are protesting the exercises with motorized caravan along the coastal areas, one originating in the city of Chennai, while the other departed from Kolkata. The vehicular caravan, which include about 1,000 cars and motorcycles, will converge in the port city of Visakhapatnam for a demonstration on Saturday. Leftist political leaders link the war games with the U.S.-India nuclear deal, the piece of legislation that has generated serious disagreement within India's Congress. Critics of the nuclear deal say it gives the U.S. too much influence over India's foreign policy, and they point to the ongoing naval exercise as an example. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
11 crew members of a popular Australian television comedy show were arrested today in Sydney as they filmed a prank inside the exclusion zone set up for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, summit. Police arrested the crew of the satirical show The Chasers War on Everything as they were producing a segment for the program, posing as members of the Canadian delegation. The stunt included a three-car motorcade with Canadian flags, accompanied by two motorcycles. The fake motorcade passed through two checkpoints before police pulled it over. The Sydney Morning Herald reports that the television crew members were arrested under sweeping new powers, given to police under laws designed specifically for the summit. Nigerian health officials have found that essential medicines donated by international agencies for free distribution are being diverted for retail sale in private pharmacies. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The essential drugs in question include medications to combat dehydration and malaria. Dehydration from diarrhea is the leading cause of death among children under 5 in developing countries, while malaria is another major disease affecting infants, children, and pregnant women. The drugs were donated to Nigeria by international health partners like the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, the Canadian Agency for International Development, and the Global Fund. The Nigerian agency that regulates drugs, the NAFDAC, discovered the scam during an investigation into missing supplies from medical storehouses. Health officials say the sale of these otherwise free drugs at prices beyond the reach of their intended recipients is seriously affecting Nigeria's effort at reducing infant and maternal mortality levels. UNICEF ranks Nigeria as number 14 in its list of countries with high infant mortality rates. Authorities have closed down some pharmacies found to have sold donated medicine. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
A new independent report on Iraq gives the Iraqi security forces a mixed review, highlighting successes and shortcomings alike. Lawmakers on both sides of the Iraq war debate have seized on the report and are using its findings to push for contradictory policies. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Iraqi security forces will be unable to independently control security in their country anytime soon. The report by a 20-member commission made up of retired U.S. military officials says one part of the Iraqi security forces, the military, is making progress and is capable of taking over internal security operations. The commission adds, though, they are unable to control or seal the Iraqi border. The real problems lay in the other half of the security forces, the police. They're plagued with sectarian violence and are ineffective, the commission says. Retired General James Jones, chair of the commission.
To reiterate, the commission's overall assessment of the ISF is that there has been measurable, though uneven, progress.
The commission also says the United States could reduce its footprint in Iraq. Retired General George Drouin provides this commentary to the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I think we need to start transitioning to an Iraqi lead, not a U.S. coalition lead, over whether it's 6 months or 12 months. I think the signs are there to do that, and we have to reduce that dependency. How many Americans that's going to take, as we say in the report, I think we have overly dependent on the logistics and support areas that can be reduced as well.
Chair of the committee, Carl Levin, says the report confirms that U.S. troops can start to withdraw.
The Iraqi forces are capable of taking on greater responsibility, and that they should do so, and that we can begin to transition our missions to border security and to support of the Iraqi forces and training rather than being in the center of civil conflict. So I think there's a lot there.
But lawmakers are using the findings to reinforce whatever position they may have on the war. Some Republicans embraced the report, saying U.S. presence in Iraq is working and more time is needed to continue training the Iraqis. This is the second report this week that will be used to frame the debate in Washington over Iraq policy. Next week, General David Petraeus will testify before Congress, and the Bush administration will deliver their version of Iraq progress. At that point, lawmakers will be forced to define their position on what sort of policy they'll support. Senator Olympia Snowe, Republican of Maine, has concerns about the war and will be a key player in the upcoming debate.
I think everybody's looking at this as sort of a watershed moment in the direction of U.S. policy in Iraq. And change will be the order of the day. There's without a doubt, and I think it's the extent and the dimensions of that change and the time frame in which it's going to occur. But I don't think there's any doubt that it will happen.
Senate Democratic leaders say they are examining a multitude of options to persuade Republicans to support their anti-war measures. One idea would be to have an end date for troop withdrawal as a goal rather than a mandatory timeline. But Democrats insist their proposal will make major changes and will include a significant reduction in U.S. troops. Assistant Democratic Leader Richard Durbin.
What we're looking for is meaningful change. As Harry Reid said, he doesn't want to see us pass a feel-good bipartisan resolution that does nothing.
Senator Durbin also says the first stage of Iraq debate will be about policy. But he predicted the real debate will come when Congress takes up the $200 billion war supplemental this fall.
And I think that there'll be a lot of efforts made to restrict and change the funding.
How long will Republican senators keep us stuck in Iraq? Should we start training our children now?
Meanwhile, a coalition of anti-war groups have launched a TV ad in the states of key Republicans to put pressure on them to end the war. The ad will be timed with next week's hearing and the Bush written report. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Moroccans will go to the polls tomorrow to elect a new parliament. Under the Moroccan electoral system, it is virtually impossible for any party to win an outright majority. The Party of Justice and Development, or PJD, is widely expected to emerge as the largest party in the Moroccan parliament following tomorrow's voting. But some observers say real change in Morocco's government won't come until the king relinquishes some of his power. Ursula Lindsay reports from Saleh in Morocco.
Morocco's two main Islamist parties are taking very different stances on this election. Though it enjoys widespread support, the Islamist group Al-Adl wal-Ihsan, Justice and Benevolence, is not recognized by the state of Morocco. Its members engage in religious seminars and social activism. They also call for the establishment of a new caliphate. Nadia Yassin is a senior member and the outspoken daughter of the group's leader. She says elections are meaningless as long as the king of Morocco doesn't give up some of his power.
Everything is in the hands of one person, the sovereign. The constitution gives all rights and all powers to one person. It's the autocracy, consecrated by the Moroccan constitution, that won't allow a real democratic system.
Al-Adl wal-Ihsan has called for a boycott of the elections, which Yassin calls window dressing.
It's not a real practice of democracy. It's a democratic attitude, a democratic show. And we refuse to play a part in this theater. So our supporters won't vote.
In contrast, Morocco's other main Islamist group, the Party of Justice and Development, or PJD, is running candidates in every district in Morocco for the first time. Abdelkader Amara is running for re-election in the city of Saleh. He visited one neighborhood in his district recently.
This is a working-class neighborhood. There are 130 to 140,000 people living here. The area was built in a chaotic way.
Volunteers for Amara's campaign circle the narrow, dirt-paved streets. They hand out flyers and sing songs. Like other PJD candidates, Amara did well in this urban slum area in the last election.
I came here with a new discourse. I said, I won't make any promises. I only promise to be nearby. I'll have offices near you, you can come see me, and I'll address the area's general problems.
These problems include poor infrastructure, unemployment, and crime. Leftists and secularists in Morocco view the rise of the Party of Justice and Development with concern. They fear if the Islamist party comes to power, it won't respect civil liberties. Some critics have accused the PJD of fostering intolerance. The PJD claims its interpretation of Islam is actually a defense against extremism. The party's programs call for promoting citizenship, family, and the Islamic identity of Morocco. During this election season, candidates have focused on fighting corruption and encouraging development. The PJD has also fielded 30 female candidates. In the slum on the edge of Saleh, a shop owner and his wife break into smiles at the sight of Amara. The shop owner explains that the PJD cleared rubble in his alley so that garbage trucks could reach it and collect its trash. His wife adds that the PJD is well known in the area. It serves the people, she says. A little further along, a young man is less emphatic. Abdel Karim Farhan says he still doesn't know who he'll vote for. Many eligible Moroccans never register to vote, and only half of those registered voted in the last election. More than 30 parties are running in this election. The Moroccan electoral system is such that it is virtually impossible for any of them to win a majority. Parties must form coalitions to rule, and these coalitions are generally brokered by the king. If the PJD becomes the biggest party in parliament, the king may still encourage Morocco's other parties not to form a coalition with it. Or the Islamist party may pass, for the first time, from being in the opposition to being in government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Saleh, Morocco.
Religious and community leaders today launched a 40-day fast in the name of debt cancellation. The effort, known as Cancel Debt Fast, is promoting passage of the Jubilee Act, a new bill that would cancel the debts of 67 of the world's poorest countries. Karen Miller has more.
Many poor nations around the world spend millions of dollars collectively each day to service debts they owe to rich countries. This money could be used for food, education, and health services. That's the goal of the D.C.-based Jubilee Network. Today, network members began a 40-day fast, during which time they will lobby on Capitol Hill to win support for the Jubilee Act. The act would cancel the debts owed by 67 countries and establish responsible lending practices for the future. David Duncan is 79 and a former preacher. He's a part of the Jubilee Network, and this is his fifth fast.
Feel like you're 100 years old. Your blood pressure drops. You go into a state of, hibernation, except your mind keeps going. And you only sleep 2 or 3 hours a night. And that gives me a great opportunity for prayer.
Kristen Sundell is Director of Advocacy for the Jubilee Network. She says the organization is using the fast to push the idea of debt cancellation because 2007 is what's known as a Sabbath year.
Which is a biblical idea that calls for debt cancellation and a new start so that nations and peoples can start again on equal footing and not have these disparities of wealth where the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. And this is a very ancient idea.
Sandel talks about the motivation behind the legislation.
A real concern that there be genuine economic justice and right relationships among nations and peoples. And the way that our international economic structure has been set up has really resulted in a situation where countries are kept in a situation of poverty due to policies that are imposed on them externally. And debt is an essential part of the puzzle to ensure that everybody is able to have their basic rights to clean water and adequate nutrition and education and health care.
People around the country will be participating in the fast on different days. Ann Fisher from York, Pennsylvania is one of them.
One of the things I keep reminding myself is that it's not about me. I can give up food for one day and I choose to give it up for this day, but there are, 13% of the world's population doesn't have a choice. They go to bed hungry every night and that's who we're representing.
The group has received support from both Democrats and Republicans. One of the issues that hampers countries from benefiting from debt collection is what's known as vulture loans. Anna Galperin from the Rutgers University School of Law talks about who makes these types of loans.
Investors who buy government debt at deep discount prices because the government is either in default or in financial distress, and then try to collect more than what they bought the debt for.
Galperin says poor countries who may have had some debts canceled now have to contend with private organizations that they need to pay back. She says the companies that do these types of loans are very sophisticated.
They have a specialized set of skills. They've developed an approach, a very aggressive and very risky approach to suing sovereign governments and maximizing their recovery through lawsuits.
Unfortunately, Galperin says for now the practice is legal.
An investor in an investment fund, just like any fund in your or my 401k plan, okay, finds an aggressive investment opportunity. The debtor defaults, and ultimately there has to be a credible threat of enforcing your contract. So their position would be that's exactly what they're doing. It's hard to argue with the proposition that these guys signed a contract, why shouldn't they pay?
Even though, according to Galperin, these types of loans don't happen very frequently, some governments are saying that debt relief efforts for the world's poorest countries are still being undermined. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
As discussion in Washington heats up about a troop pullout from Iraq, commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reflects on the long-term effects of the war.
Speaking before Veterans of Foreign Affairs group recently, U.S. President George W. Bush evoked the slaughter, concentration camps, and devastation following the U.S. pullout from Vietnam to warn against the costs of a precipitous withdrawal from the Iraq debacle. The argument boiled down to the recent conservative claim that if the U.S. leaves Iraq now, it'll result in a societal bloodbath. There is something quite unseemly about a man who, when he was of age, declined to go to Vietnam, now arguing for its lessons before men who did go, some of whom have lost limbs. There is another odd, almost surreal quality to hearing the president, who went to war on the most naked of lies, who authorized a bombing campaign called Shock and Awe, who sent the entire region into a tizzy of maddening discontent, which led to the deaths of an estimated 600,000 Iraqis, argue about the costs of withdrawal. His stay the course is as empty an echo as was that of one of his presidential predecessors, Lyndon B. Johnson, when he called for troop increases in Vietnam. What is missing from his convenient lesson in Vietnam is the reckoning of just how much pain, suffering, and death was visited upon the Vietnamese by the American war. According to many sources, some 3 million Vietnamese were killed by U.S. military forces. The number isn't clear simply because, as they were Asians, it wasn't necessary for an accurate count. What Bush conveniently forgot to mention was the continuing costs of war facing Vietnam because of the U.S. use of toxic chemicals such as the defoliant Agent Orange. The U.S. dropped over 10 million gallons of that poison on Vietnam, and the country still suffers from this aerial assault. According to Anthony Orneau's The Logic of Withdrawal, some 4 million people suffered from this barrage, which has left an untold number with serious birth defects and has caused an unprecedented environmental and ecological damage to the rural regions. A recent civil lawsuit against Dow Chemical, which created the weapon, was dismissed by U.S. courts. Perhaps there are lessons to be learned from Vietnam after all, but not the ones the Bush regime may wish to address. Recent Bush administration criticisms of Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki that his government is ineffective and doesn't listen enough to his American paymasters sounds eerily similar to mumbled musings against South Vietnam's President Ngo Dinh Diem. The CIA let key military leaders know that the U.S. was losing faith in their chosen puppet and thus laid the groundwork for a military coup that not only toppled Diem's government, but led to his brutal assassination. Are we witnessing the opening stages of this lesson being replayed in Iraq? Let us not think for a moment that the U.S. doesn't prefer generals to presidents, or, as in Pakistan's Musharraf, both for the price of one. The history of 20th century Latin America has been one of an American love affair with generals, and, yes, with death squads, many trained in the infamous School of the Americas, since renamed at Fort Benning, Georgia. W., who was apparently a poor student of history, is not much better as a teacher, for For if this is the only lesson learned from Vietnam, then he needs to go back to summer school. One lesson is that lies and scare tactics may lead people to war, but it won't keep them there once they learn the truth. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
World-famous tenor Luciano Pavarotti died last night in Modena City at the age of 71. Pavarotti has long been known for his clear voice and his efforts to bring opera to a broader audience. Less known, however, was his humanitarian commitment. Diletta Varlese reports from Italy.
Luciano Pavarotti died last night in Modena City, Italy, after a long-term battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 71 years old, and he spent 50 years of his life devoted to music. Pavarotti performed on stages throughout the world, from Central Park in New York to Eiffel Tower in Paris and Hyde Park in London. Mara De Feo is one of the thousands of Italians who enjoyed Pavarotti's concerts.
Una perdita artistica ed umana.
I believe this has been an enormous human and artistic loss. I think Pavarotti represented all of us Italians in the world, and he did it in the best way. When I was at his concert, the most impressive thing I remember was the enthusiasm he gave to all his fans. I believe his humanitarian commitment was genuine, and it was generous. I have no doubt that this helped many children in critical countries because he managed to touch and involve a lot of artists worldwide.
Besides his musical contributions, Pavarotti is also remembered for his humanitarian commitment, represented by the international event Pavarotti and Friends. The income from this series of concerts was devolved for humanitarian aid in various parts of the world, particularly to improve conditions for children in war conflicts. In a 2002 interview, Pavarotti said he wanted nothing more than to help children.
You cannot do anything better than help children. Children are the innocent result of the stupidity of the old people, of the adult.
Funeral services for Pavarotti will be celebrated on Saturday in the Modena Dome. Reporting from Brescia, Italy, I'm Diletta Varlese for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Tena Gisi and Aura Bogado. Monica Lopez returns next week. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein, Antonio Ortiz, and Puck Lowe. In New York, I'm Kat Aaron.
Forse non